Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, as we approach the 50th anniversary of Vatican II, the editor of America magazine reflects on how that event influenced his life and work. Educating young people in justice and peace. We look at the mission of Bethlehem University, providing quality education for young Christians and Muslims. And the Anglican Centre in Rome, striving to promote Christian unity 52 weeks of the year. This year, 2012, the Church is celebrating the 50th anniversary of the opening of the Second Vatican Council on October the 11th, 1962, a landmark event that would last for 3 years and profoundly shape the future of the Catholic Church, not to mention its relations with other churches and other religious traditions.
I mean, I followed it on radio. I was a high school student when it opened.
Jesuit Father Drew Christensen is editor-in-chief of America magazine and author of numerous works on justice, peace and conflict resolution. During the 1990s, Father Drew headed the U.S. Catholic Bishops' Justice and Peace Office and later continued to advise the Bishops' Conference, especially in the field of support for the Christian churches in the Holy Land. During a recent visit to Rome, I sat down with him to talk about the impact of the Council on his work and in particular the effects of Pope John's great social encyclical from that period, Pacem in Terris. First question I'm going to ask you is a personal one in a sense. Where were you at Vatican II? I know you were ordained 10 years after it started, so you were quite a young kid then.
No,
what memories do you have of that event?
Well, when I officially opened, I was a novice. But with the announcements at the beginning of January and the previous December, I was a high school student and then a novice. So we followed it closely in initiate. We didn't ordinarily get newspapers as novices, but we were able to get reportage on the council, and there were people who had been at the council or who had been in Rome and preparing for the council who came to meet with us and chat with us about issues. And I remember Vincent McCormick, who had been the American assistant for the Jesuits and confessor for Pius XII, came and shortly before his death, and someone asked him, we were all very enamored of the liturgy in those days and liturgical renewal, and someone asked him about whether there would be a vernacular liturgy. He said, oh, the Holy Spirit will never allow it. So, but we could follow it, and as soon as the documents came out, they were made available to us to read and study and so on.
So was there a sense back then of really what a momentous event this was in the life of the Church?
Oh, I think so. There was a lot of excitement because there hadn't been one in nearly 100 years. And the tone that John 23rd had set was that it was to engage the world and be a pastoral council. And so this was all new. And a lot of other initiatives were taking place in conjunction with it. The predecessor of the Secretariat for Christian Unity had been set up. Cardinal Bea, Jesuit, was doing negotiations with bringing the Orthodox to the council. But in addition to that, Cardinal Slippy was being released from imprisonment, and so was Father Chizek. And Father Chizek came back and lived at America House when he first came to the U.S. We have a picture on our wall of him smiling. He's sitting in the fedora in the car door. And someplace we have a document in code that says Mr. X will be returning and such a date. And it was a coded message that Chizik was coming back and would be coming to the States.
So in fact, the political changes, the upheavals on the political right. scene were being very much reflected in the Church as
That's
well.
That's right. Oh, yes, yeah. And that was part of what John 23rd was doing. I mean, there was, in addition to John Amento in the Church, there was an outreach in politics, both here in Italy, which was very controversial, reaching beyond the Christian Democrats, and worldwide, which led eventually to his relationship with Khrushchev and negotiation over the Cuban Missile Crisis, in which he was a back-channel negotiator. And then finally, after that crisis, he announces to his doctors that he wants to write an encyclical, which becomes Pacem in Terris, and it gets written within a few months.
That document has been very much your guiding light, hasn't it, over the years since then? Is that fair to say?
Well, yes, partly because it really, even more than Modern Magistra, his first encyclical, it really kind of enters the modern world and engages what is lowercase Anglo-American liberal political philosophy with human rights, which you know, had been rejected by Pius IX and never formally accepted anywhere. And finally, he kind of accepts it, and we have our own Catholic human rights theory, but it also becomes the kind of groundwork for the Church's political theology, official political theology, you know, subsequently. And
where do you think his inspiration came from? As you say, he really went against the prevailing views within the Church, or that had been within the Church for many centuries.
Well, yes, that's right. Personally, there are sources in that he was a part of the Catholic youth movement and the social movement, liberal social, Catholic social movements here in Italy, along with then Monsignor Montini, later Paul VI. And then I think his work as an historian gave him a broader perspective. I mean, he did the major work on Charles Borromeo's reform in Milan. And I think being an historian rather than a theologian or a canonist, he had a different perspective of the way things go in history. And then I think his diplomatic experience, you know, there was that experience of working in crisis and resolving difficult situations, and that you could talk to people. I mean, they're
working in places where Catholics were a minority,
right,
as well.
Right. I mean, in the late 40s or after the war, when they're beginning to the work on the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, there were conversations going on in Paris where he was nuncio. And although Pius during the war had announced a program quite like the Universal Declaration, because they couldn't arrive at its speculative foundation, he was not ready to buy in. I mean, there was a pragmatic foundation that we can agree on the practical principles, we can't agree on what, how they derive. We'll talk about human dignity and so on, which is what the Church has done ever since. But Pius XII kind of withdrew. But René Cassin, a French legal scholar, a non-Catholic, said that Roncalli several times gave him encouragement to continue the work on human rights during that period. So he was engaged there. And I think the other was he was in close contact with Pietro Pavan, who was, I think, the rector at the Lateran University at that time, who was a famous liberal Catholic. He did for Italy what Maritain had done for Catholic political philosophy in France. And he was a defender of democracy against fascism and defender of human rights and other things. And had been a consultant, I think, on Mater Magistra, but he did the major early drafts of Pacimentarius as well. And then with John Murray, who was the major ghostwriter behind the Declaration on Religious Freedom as well. So I think his association with Pavan was very important there as well.
Looking at Pacimentarius, what would you pick out as the most significant contributions, if you like, to the current justice and peace movement?
I think in the current context, I think that the notion that human rights in general are especially realized in the notion of religious freedom is important. That was important for John. He mentions in the very early speeches prior to the council that he hoped the council would contribute to peace by promoting human rights, especially religious freedom. And I think that's still an important issue, although it can be misused. And I think in terms of our current situation, Pope Benedict has continued this tradition. John was the first one to take the notion of the common good, which had been tied incorrectly, I think, to the nation state, because it had been applied to different political entities, over to the empire, to city states, you know, and then to nation states. But, you know, we looked as if the last 300 or 400 years were all of history when they weren't. But he applied it to a situation where the world was becoming interdependent, and therefore developed the notion of the universal common good and the need to have institutions that would deal with worldwide problems. And we're beginning to see that with the International Criminal Court, for instance, with various kinds of regimes and potential regimes like those on climate change and so on, that can deal with global problems. The World Trade Organization would be another. So that his vision is there, and the Holy See continues to promote. It's been part of the vision. It's part of that universal vision, which is very Catholic, to promote, as John called it, socialization, that is, any activity in the world that brings people together and helps them work together. And so the universal common good is very important, and especially in this age of globalization. Benedict has been emphatic about that, especially in Caritas in Veritate.
My thanks there to Jesuit Father Drew Christiansen, editor-in-chief of America Magazine. In this year in which Pope Benedict focused his World Peace Day message on educating young people in the ways of justice and peace, we take a look now at one institution which aims to do just that. Bethlehem University will shortly be marking its 40th anniversary, the first university established in the West Bank by the Vatican and the De La Salle Christian Brothers in 1973. From just over 100 students back then, it now has over 3,000 young men and women, Christian and Muslim, taught by a dedicated Palestinian and international staff in an increasingly difficult political context.
We have to remain hopeful that sometime, hopefully sooner than later, that peace will prevail and then things will be much better for everyone.
Dr. Yuil Anastas is Vice President of the University for Financial and Administrative Affairs. That means, amongst other things, trying to raise funds and increase international support in increasingly challenging circumstances.
It was established upon the wish and request of Pope Paul VI after his visit to Bethlehem and the Palestinian territory, where he asked the people there about their most urgent need, and many people mentioned to him the need for higher education institution in Palestine or the West Bank. And from there it started, and of course, given the presence of the De La Salle brothers in Bethlehem, the historical presence actually, since they've been there since the 1890s as a secondary school in Bethlehem, in Jerusalem, as well as in Jaffa and Nazareth, the Bethlehem University started then in partnership between the Vatican and the De La Salle brothers.
So right from the beginning, it was a school which included all local people, Muslims and Christians.
It's from the beginning that included the Muslims and Christians, yes. Yes, indeed.
It's had a checkered history since then, hasn't it, in its almost 40 years?
Yes, actually, it's not a secret. Actually, the politics is a big challenge for us as an educational institution. Politics, as you may know, there is an element that plays and has influence in almost every aspect of life there, including, of course, education and higher education. Bethlehem University experienced many closures in its life, experienced even violence at certain points of time.
You actually had rockets fired into the university.
Into the university, and it hit the library of the university and some other buildings.
But no casualties, fortunately.
Fortunately, no casualties, no. But then we have, other than the political challenge, we have also the financial challenge. The economic situation in the Palestinian territory does not allow us to charge high tuition and fees to students. So basically what we're charging students comes even less than half of what they cost Bethlehem University. So fundraising and financial support is another major challenge for us as Bethlehem University. And then there is the aspect of development and enlargement of the university. Bethlehem University is located not in the very center of Bethlehem, but it's in a populated area of Bethlehem. So there is very much limited land around it for enlargement. Now, Bethlehem area as a whole has also much limited land because, as you know, the wall that's surrounding it and the settlements also from the southern and eastern and western part, of course, of Bethlehem. So that's another challenge that we are facing. Actually, right now, we're in the process of looking for possibilities. Where can we have more land or have more buildings so that we can enlarge our program and our population?
So tell us something about the student population. Who are the majority of your students? Where do they come from? And what do they go on to do when they graduate?
Well, it depends when. If you're asking me right now, it's much different than the population when I was at the university. Actually, I was a student of Bethlehem University between 82 and 86. And then the population was very much diverse. I remember I had colleagues and friends from all the way from southern Gaza all the way to northern West Bank and north of Jenin in the West Bank. Little by little, this population became more and more limited.
As difficulties for traveling, yes.
Actually, this started with the first Intifada in 1990 when the Israeli government started imposing checkpoints on the roads and started closing towns in whether in West Bank or in Gaza. So up till 1990, the population was very much diverse. Right now, we have maybe 85% of the population comes from Bethlehem area. We have maybe about 10% that comes from Jerusalem, another maybe 5% from Hebron, and very few students, that's less than 1%, that comes from Nablus, Jenin, or Ramallah areas.
So, and no one from Gaza. There was a student whose story made the news headlines, didn't it?
Yes, indeed. Berlanti Azam was a student at Bethlehem University who was finishing her fourth year of studies and went from Bethlehem to Ramallah to have an interview for work once she graduates. And then on her way back, she was stopped at one of the checkpoints, and then it was discovered that she's actually from Gaza and not from the West Bank. And right then she was arrested, detained, and then sent back to Gaza. Although Bethlehem University tried a lot through the Israeli court system to protest this measure and let Berlanti finish her studies, but that was not possible, actually. And she was returned to Gaza.
She had a special degree ceremony, didn't she, all of her own, I believe, in
Yes,
Gaza.
In Gaza with our Vice Chancellor, Brother Peter Bray, and our Chancellor, who is the nuncio actually in Jerusalem, His Excellency Archbishop Antonio Franco, who went to Gaza especially for that event. Yes. And actually, since several years right now, Bethlehem University is trying to get students out of Gaza to come to pursue studies at Bethlehem University, but until now it's not possible. We have had no student coming from Gaza to Bethlehem University since at least 6 or 7 years.
It must be quite difficult to keep your faculty, your staff, under these kind of conditions.
Yes, indeed. Actually, I recall many of the teachers or lecturers and professors who were there at the time when I was a student. And when I came back as an employee of the university, I was asking about them, and many of them, they preferred to leave the university because it was no longer possible for them to come either from Nablus in the north of the West Bank or from Ramallah, which is even nearest, like half an hour distance from Bethlehem. But because of the checkpoints and the closure of Jerusalem for Palestinians, it makes it impossible for them to come every day and teach at Bethlehem University, so they left the university. And of course, it's the same for students. I mean, it's not easy for a student to come from the Northwest Bank to Bethlehem to pursue his studies. So yes, indeed, I mean, many has left the university because of that.
Tell us something about your own story. You were a student there, you then went abroad, didn't you? What made you come back?
Frankly, because first, I love my country. That's one thing. And the second thing, I think it's out of duty, if you wish. As you know, I don't have an army, so I have not served the army of my country. I did not do any national service. And part of it is doing this national service because I believe if everyone, like in my case, leaves the country and does not come back, then we're having no more Palestinian people, let's say, because then we'll be all in diaspora adopting new nationalities.
There is, in fact, a larger diaspora, isn't there, in countries like Chile, for example,
or yes.
In the United States?
Oh, yes. In Central America, you have, even like talking about the micro level, Bethlehem has much more residents in El Salvador and in Honduras than you have in Bethlehem right now. That's very much true. And that's why it's very important. Actually, every person that comes back counts, actually, to the country. And happily enough, there are some people that are coming back, although not in the numbers that we hope for, but there are some people that are coming back. And at the same time, we hope that the people who are already there do not leave the country for good. Actually, if someone leaves for studies, I personally encourage that because we need to be open to new culture, for new educational opportunities, but at the same time not to leave the country for good because that's not in anybody's favor, actually.
Difficult, though, to convince people, particularly with young families, for example, as the Catholic Church is finding, difficult to convince them to stay with so little hope of any kind of political solution on the horizon.
That's true, and that's reality, actually, because, for example, I would say I'm lucky to have this employment opportunity with Bethlehem University, but I mean, there is a limited number where Bethlehem University can hire people. There is also a limited number where other institutions also can hire people. So not too many find employment opportunities. And then the choice would be for them either to sit idle at home or to go abroad and then live in dignity and, you know, like winning their daily bread. So, and that's the choice where many people are faced with, and then they have to leave the country. And I'm sure if you ask many of those people, if you find a good employment opportunity back in your own hometown, in whether Bethlehem, Ramallah, or Nablus, they would for sure come back. Actually, coming here to Rome from Amman, because we go first to Amman, we're not allowed to use Tel Aviv airport, I met on the airplane one of the prominent Palestinian businessmen. This person who made a big fortune abroad preferred to come back and build a big house in the West Bank, in Nablus. And he wanted to make the point, yes, that although I made a successful life abroad, but then my home remains Palestine. And then he came back and built this. So there are people for whom it is possible to do that. They come back and they stay in Bethlehem, but it's not possible for everyone.
As you say, for those who haven't made millions abroad, for the ordinary people of Palestine, can you give us any signs of hope?
The only hope we have is to have peace. If we have peace in Palestine and in the area, then yes, I see hope for many of those to be able to come back to their towns and villages, to come back to their homes where they prefer to live. But unfortunately, until now, I'm not seeing any of that. And I cannot be optimistic. I'm trying to be, but I cannot. But we have to be, we have to remain hopeful that sometime, hopefully sooner than later, that peace will prevail and then things will be much better for everyone.
You're here in the Vatican and in Rome discussing fundraising, but also awareness raising. What do you really expect from the Christian community outside of the Holy Land? What else can people do who want to be involved, who want to support Bethlehem University and its future students?
You mentioned that actually they can help in two areas. First of all, awareness to others, to their peers, to their colleagues, to their friends, for those in Europe and the States, to their representatives at the governments, that there's Christian population living in Palestine, living in Bethlehem, and looking for peace, and then that they push their governments to help achieve peace in the Middle East. The other front is the financial support to institutions, especially educational institutions and health institutions, to support them financially, because there is no way that these institutions can survive and serve the Palestinian Christians without the external financial support. The economic situation there is very bad. I know that it's also bad in other parts of the world, but if it's bad in the other parts of the world, that means it's even worse in Palestine. So their financial support is very much appreciated there.
And finally, Bethlehem is always keen to welcome any groups of pilgrims, isn't it, Bethlehem University?
Oh, yes, we receive groups on daily basis, and many of them, actually, they do come back to Bethlehem University for second and the third time. They like it very much. They found it enlightening. They learn many things that they do not hear when they are in their own countries. So, I encourage everyone thinking of coming there to actually come there and see and learn about the situation there and see his Christian brothers, how they live, how they survive in that area of the world.
Thanks there to Dr. Yuil Anastas, Vice President of Bethlehem University for Financial and Administrative Affairs. The annual Week of Prayer for Christian Unity may have drawn to a close here in Rome with the celebration of Vespers by Pope Benedict on Wednesday in the Basilica of St. Paul outside the walls. Yet the work of promoting unity and cooperation between the different Christian churches continues as a priority throughout the rest of the year. One place here in Rome, which is the focus for regular ecumenical encounters and conversations, is the Anglican Centre, located in the imposing Palazzo Doria Pamphili. Set up in the wake of the Second Vatican Council, the centre has an important library, runs educational courses, welcomes pilgrims to Rome, and every Tuesday hosts a Eucharist and informal lunch for people of all religious backgrounds or none. Its current director is Canon David Richardson.
We're marking this week of prayer for Christian unity, but in a way this Anglican Centre here in Rome has the task of encouraging and promoting Christian unity 52 weeks of the year. Tell us a little bit about the way the centre tries to do that.
We were set up, if I can just run a bit of history, we were set up in the 1960s with a mission to the director of the Anglican Centre is the Archbishop of Canterbury, representative to the Holy See. And so in that capacity, I represent the communion to the Vatican, and I try to interpret the Vatican to the Anglican communion using the office of the Archbishop of Canterbury as the conduit for the communion. It was set up to be a hospitable place where, at a time when it was recognised that the Anglican Church of the Western Churches had a particular number of particular marks of Catholicity and therefore a particular relationship with the Roman Catholic Church, it was set up to be a place where Roman Catholics could learn more about Anglicanism and what Anglicans believe and what Anglican ecclesiology is. So we have a large library, which is a resource for students, Roman Catholic students, Anglican students, of ecumenism and of ecclesiology. We also run courses, a number of courses a year, and they're all ecumenically based and they're all cross-denominational in some way or another.
You also have an open afternoon here, a mass and an open forum here, don't you, in a way, bringing together people from all sorts of Christian denominations right across the spectrum, and non-Christians too?
We do. Once a week, on a Tuesday, we have a Eucharist at 12:45. And, I mean, it's a very tiny chapel, the Chapel of St. Augustine of Canterbury, and he seats at a crush 30 people. But the people who come here, there's a small group of people who come regularly, and that group consists of Anglicans, Roman Catholics, Methodists, those who in conscience can't or in discipline can't receive communion don't, but they come to share the fellowship, they come to be fed by the word, and they come to, some of them in fact come because they've got involved in one of our courses and like what they found. We get people from quite unexpectedly from all around the world, and it's a small congregation, and they come, and then after the Eucharist we give them lunch, and which opens up communications and conversations and joys and possibilities of ministry in all sorts of places.
So a real tiny success story, albeit far away from the news spotlight, but something that works and really makes progress in this ecumenical relations.
I think that's absolutely right. It's a tiny kind of microcosm of what the whole ecumenical movement's about, in a way, of people acknowledging, recognising their differences and recognising too that relationships aren't thereby hurt or damaged. You work out ways of building bridges and witnessing to that.
My thanks there to Canon David Richardson, director of the Anglican Centre here in Rome. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio, Laudato Jesus Christus.